You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Good afternoon. Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison, and I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. Our topic today is the book, Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with People Like Us. And our guest is the amazing author, Sarah H. Elliston. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for inviting me.
I have to tell you, when I heard about your book, I was so excited about this topic, which may sound strange that I'd be happy to learn about difficult people, but I was like, wow, what a fantastic topic. So thank you so much for writing this precious book.
You're very welcome. I'm glad you liked it.
I did. I liked it very much. Now, you say that difficult people are clueless and that difficult people don't know what they are doing to annoy others.
That's true. That's what I say. I'm using myself as an example. I didn't know until I was 50 years old that I really was, much of my behavior was really annoying to people. I thought I had quirks and I was, you know, perky and argumentative and interesting, and I had all kinds of positive words for me, but in fact, I was driving my colleagues kind of crazy at that point, and I had a boss, someone that I really respected. That's always important when you're in a developing this kind of an information conversation. Someone I really respected who said to me, "Do you know you're doing this?" And I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And she said, "Hey, the next time you do it, I'll point it out." It was not a big deal. She just said, "On top of all the things you're doing well, did you know you do this thing that's really kind of annoying?" And so a couple of weeks later, I had misplaced my very first pair of real glasses, you know, reading glasses. They were outrageously expensive. And to this day, I don't know what happened to them. But I was scurrying around my little cubicle, you know, picking things up and dropping them and opening drawers and slamming them and lifting up the flippers that they have in cubicles to cover up the shelves and dropping them and just, you know, sitting down and then muttering and standing up and walking out to the office to my car and coming back. And I don't know how long I did it for, but at one point she leaned out her door. She said, "Hey, come into my office for a minute." And I did. And I mean, I was like, "Oh," and she said, "That, what you're doing right now, that has to stop." And I said, what am I doing? I literally did not know that I was having this little, whatever you call it, snit fit temper tantrum, whirling dervish kind of behavior. And I mean, it was such a habit, and it was so much a part of me that I didn't know I was doing it. And what she said was, of course, we can't make any phone calls. We can't really focus on our work when you're doing that because it creates, you know, noise and negative energy, and it's hard to focus. So I immediately stopped at that moment and sat down and started thinking about it. And over the next period of months and years, I talked to my husband and our son, and they both confirmed, "Oh, yes, you've always done this."
Now, this is interesting. And, now, now this was as an adult, and this was an excellent boss who actually took the time, you know, rather than terminating you, took the time.
Well, go ahead.
Right.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I'd worked at this company for almost 20 years at this point, and I got pretty good performance reviews. I was really good at my job. And what almost all my supervisors would say things like, "You know, the one area, you know, we're not going to grade you as high on is that you could really work on your communication skills. You might want to think about that."
But take us back. Can you take us back to your childhood? I mean, were you a lot like that as a child as well?
Yeah, I think I try. In the book, I describe, I don't know, there's about 30 pages of information about what I think fed into my being a difficult person. And for everyone else, it's, you know, for everybody, it's different. But I was the middle of three girls, and the way the age ranged, the two of them played together well, and I was kind of the thorn in everybody's side, if you will. And I was born like, we want to do it my way. And they said, no, we'll do it your way. And so I never felt like I belonged. That was part of it. They did also pick on me. I mean, you know, as adults, we've acknowledged that they did kind of bully me in some ways, not physically, and I didn't get hit in any way, but emotionally, I got teased a lot. And of course, it worked. It hurt my feelings terribly. So they, why wouldn't you keep doing it if it works? And so I developed a fairly thin skin for picking up people being mean to me and developing resentments and always waiting for someone, you know, always having one eye kind of looking out the back of my head to see if my older sister was going to say or do something that was going to get me into trouble or make me look bad in some way. And that's how I evolved. So I challenged authority all the time. And when I was speaking with what I called passion, you know, for something that I cared about, there was an underlying tone, I guess, of resentment and anger and rage, probably. I remember talking about, I worked in the field of volunteer management. That was one of the thing that I did the most, although I was a teacher all my life, but for the 25 years that I worked for United Way, part of my job always involved managing volunteer programs, teaching other people how, and I was at a conference completely divorced from my work, and someone asked me about volunteers and volunteering, and I kind of got on my high horse about the role of the manager of volunteers and on, and they were interested, and one of them said, you're really passionate about this. And I thought, oh, I guess that's my passion. I hadn't thought about it. I guess I thought I was really angry about it. So she may have been trying to reframe it, but it was an interesting experience. So I think the other thing that was going on in my family was it was easier if I wasn't there. And so what my sisters observed was my mother always trying to figure out what to do to make Sarah happy. You know, we send her to a friend's house for the weekend, or, well, we're going to go do this, but Sarah, we'll find something for her to do because she won't want to do it with us, which was true. I probably didn't want to do it with them because when you have three little girls in the back seat of a car, someone has to sit in the middle. And I never wanted to be in the middle because I felt picked on there. I said, well, if you put me in the middle and I can't have the air blowing on my face, I'll throw up. And they did it anyway, and I threw up. I mean, I wasn't...
But, you know, I'm listening to you, and mm-hmm. when I listen to you and how you were when you were younger, you just seem like someone who had a strong sense of self. Mm-hmm. You seemed very sure about, which is... not many children are like that. You knew what you liked, what you didn't like, what you wanted to do and what you didn't want to do. I mean, my goodness, you sound like you were pretty evolved, you know, as a child.
And I think most of my friends' parents would say that I was kind of a little brat.
But when I wasn't with my family, I wasn't.
Now, I would go and stay with my friend, my best friend. Her name is Dodie, Dorothy. Dodie is a pet name for Dorothy. And we were really good buds. And her parents thought the sun rose and set on me. I loved being at her house. She was an only child. And so and we had different skills. She was really artistic and could draw all the dolls and the clothes for the paper dolls and all these. I just loved being at her house because her parents liked me. Now, it wasn't that my parents didn't like me, but I was one of three. And when I was around, there was usually tension.
But that's interesting, though. But you seem like you weren't the kind of child that people could really pick on. Or were you?
Well, I mean, they did. Some of the things, this sounds really silly, although I do put it in the book. At night, the way our bedrooms were laid out, I had one sister on one side and one on the other. And we were down like a long wing. So we were, our bedrooms were down at a wing. And then at the other end of that wing was the main part of the house with the kitchen and the living room, dining room. And then our parents' room was off that part of the house. So if they were in bed, they couldn't hear what we were doing. And if there was a babysitter sitting out in the living room, she didn't know what was going on. And so I would be in bed and my sisters would walk through the dark and come into my room and jump out and go, gar, gar, and sort of try to scare me. And it worked. Scare me to death. And every time I tried to do it to them, they had always planned something that would scare me more. So it's really interesting how something that simple. My older sister is very good. She's kind of cryptic and very smart. And she was able to, you know, I could say something, I can't think of an example, but I could say something like, oh, my God, look how pretty the sky is. And she'd say, yep, it's the sky, all right. And so not saying it wasn't pretty, but just trying to take it down a notch. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Do you know people like that? Well, it led to my doubting whether what I felt and what I thought was, say, pretty in this case was accurate. And she was my older sister, you know, she was the boss, kind of, and so it was tough. But I don't tell you all this stuff to tell you that I was a victim of it. I own the fact that I had a strong personality. They've written books about raising strong children, as a matter of fact. I had a strong personality. My friends of my mother's used to tell me that I was very like my mother. And so that probably pushed all her buttons, too. So it made it harder for her to set boundaries for me or discipline me or know what to do to help me be happy. So that we sort of evolved. And that then, as I, of course, I grew up, I was in school in the 60s and 70s, and we were arguing with authority every step of the way.
But I have a question for you. Yeah. What is the difference between being protective, strong, confident, and difficult? What is the difference, really?
Well, I think the way I would look at it, if I was trying to look at me that way, say I would say to myself, well, I'm being protective and strong and confident and I know what I like. That would be true, especially if I was feeling very, very safe. The minute you put me in a top-down environment or where somebody was holding something over my head or I felt unsafe, there would be an underlying current of anger or sarcasm or negativity or complaining around the edges.
But wouldn't that be normal for most people, though? If you're if anyone is in an environment where they feel safe, your instinct is to protect, right? Or
well,
to fight back.
Okay, so for me, I think I developed a sense that authority was not on my side. And so I was always pushing against it. Where I am now is I understand authority, and I thank God I'm not it. You know, I don't want to be in charge of whatever the activity is that I'm involved with. I just want to push the button or push the wheel down the road. I've had that responsibility, and it's not much fun. And I don't think whoever's in charge is out to get me.
So do you, would you say then that for a difficult person, perhaps they take too much to heart or take too many things personally? And so
I think
they,
being difficult, yeah. Yeah, that's probably part of it. As a difficult person would be taking things very personally. If they take it personally and then they spew it out on everybody else. I mean, they can take it personally and go home and stew on it. That's fine. But if they bring it back to whatever they're going to do the next day and start criticizing or acting differently towards people because they think, oh, you made me feel this way or you hurt my feelings, that would be difficult. Part of what my book is trying to teach is that we have to be responsible for our own behavior. We can't blame it on our parents or our environment or our world. We have to be responsible for us. We can blame it on our food if we get to choose our food.
Now, someone today who is blaming everything on their parents, it's because my mother did it. What do you say to them?
Oh, well, first of all, the reason that I'd be talking to this person is because I guess she's difficult, right?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay, so let's assume she's difficult. So what I would do is say to her, do you know you're doing this behavior? And do you know it has this impact on customers, clients, family members, me, us, the whatever? Are you aware that you're doing it? Are you aware it has this impact? Was this your intent? Did you want to piss everybody off, so to speak? And if she said, it's not my fault, it's what my mother did, she made me do it, I'd say, I hear you, and your mother's not here. Are you willing to change? Do you want to change? Now, I wouldn't maybe probably be quite so blunt, you know, in the real world. I would have to listen to her complain about her mom for a while and tell me stories about how awful her mom was or whatever it was. One of the things that I teach or I write in the book is the sort of the exercise of active listening, where you listen to what's underneath the story, the emotion. So it's not my fault. It's my mother's fault. Well, so you're feeling that I'm blaming you for something, that I'm saying that you're a bad person. Is that what you're feeling? And so I said, well, yeah, because I'm just doing what I was taught. And I'm saying, cool. Are you telling me that maybe you could learn something different? Are you interested? Because what you're doing isn't working, and it's turning away customers or it's dropping the productivity, whatever the impact is. If that wasn't your intent, if your intent was to be a good working member of our team, are you willing to try something different?
Ah, yeah.
And your mom's not here, you know. She sounds like she was horrible, and she's not here. So what are we going to do? So part of this is being able to, as the person talking to a difficult person, you know, for the reader, I am very aware that saying that kind of thing to someone or having that conversation is not the easiest thing in the world, which is why nobody did it with me, because I think they thought I would burst into tears or say something hateful and argumentative, and nobody wanted it. You know, it's like, oh God, there's a woman now, and she's going to blow up at me. Who wants that, right?
Now, just tell us, now, you explained how your boss, you know, who was very kind to take the time to...
And very direct.
And very, very direct yeah, to tell you about you and to tell you that she thought you were a very difficult person. But when did
she never actually used those words. She just said, what you're doing that needs to stop. It's driving us all crazy. And I didn't know what I was doing.
Right. But when did you realize or even have an inkling that you were a difficult person? I mean, did you have any inkling at all before that conversation?
I knew, yeah, a little bit. I knew that I didn't quite fit. I couldn't seem to find a place to fit anywhere, and that I was fairly riddled with self-doubt because I would think I'd be doing something and then I'd get a reaction. I thought, oh, I shouldn't have said that or I shouldn't have done that. a couple of years before she had this conversation with me, I had gotten sober. So I had learned, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, good. We had a beep there. What was I going to say? Oh, I was beginning to think or understand that maybe I wasn't in charge of the world. And I think maybe difficult people, at least the people that I know who are in recovery, they describe themselves. Some of the characteristics of difficult people are also the characteristics of people who are addicts or alcoholics, at least for me. That's true. So I had started, as a friend of mine would say, started to commence to begin to believe that maybe I wasn't in charge of the world and there was something else in charge and maybe I should listen and learn a little bit instead of always having the right opinion or always thinking I was right and arguing for what I believed. So that was part of probably why I heard her. But no one had ever said anything like that to me before. As I relate in the book, one of my friends told me that I had, quote, hurt her feelings. And I kept saying, I can't hurt your feelings, you know. Eleanor Roosevelt has a quote about that, you know. The only person that can hurt your feelings is you. And whatever it was that I said, it's the way you're taking it, it's the way you're perceiving it that's making it hurtful. This certainly wasn't said to be hurtful.
Hmm. That's interesting, listening to you saying that to her. Because
she didn't get it. She didn't get it at all. No, she really was a wonderful woman, and she was doing her very best. The problem was we were teaching something called reality therapy and choice theory. And choice theory, one of the principles is that we're responsible for our own behavior. Hmm. And so we're responsible for how we react. The world just gives us information. It's how we perceive it is then leads to our emotional thinking and doing and physiological reactions. And that's what we were teaching. We were teaching it together, and she was saying, but you really hurt my feelings. I said, I can't hurt your feelings. Come on. Look at what we're teaching together here. I probably wasn't very patient with her.
Or would you say that you lacked sensitivity at that particular time?
I mean, probably, sure. Because right. I was, honestly, she was a certified counselor, and I am not. And she had lots more experience in counseling than I did. And we were both teaching for a professor here as instructors for him. And I thought she knew this stuff cold. It never occurred to me that I was kind of slapping her across the face.
Yeah.
But I remember coming home and saying to my husband, I don't get it. Why would she say that to me?
But we are responsible for our own behavior. It's a lot easier to say it and probably a lot easier to teach it, or as they say, to talk the talk. But to mm-hmm. actually to live it, it's a lot tougher to be out there. If someone says something really grueling to you, it's very hard to not to have some sort of inner reaction to it. I mean,
of
we
course
are
you have a reaction, sure, but
right.
then you are responsible for thinking about it and not blaming your reaction on someone else.
Ah, okay.
I mean it
but there are some people, and I'm sure you'll agree, there are some mm-hmm. people who like getting people to react. They want to see people get angry, and they, you know, they do
I know,
things.
I delight.
Yeah, they
I
get.
Have, I've been doing a lot of interviewing, and some of the interviewers are like that, and so I really enjoy not reacting or agreeing with them. Sometimes I just agree with them. Oh, you're probably right. And oops. One of the things that I've learned is that if you give someone, if someone's blowing at you, you take the sail out of their wind. And if they have no wind, then you know, you have to put your sail up. Or if they have no, if they've got a sail up and they don't have any, I don't know how the other way goes. But when someone's blowing at me, I have learned to often, one gentleman who was quite annoyed with me for whatever reason. I remember thinking, well, you know, you're absolutely right. I apologize. Shouldn't have said that. Didn't hurt me at all. And it changed the whole tone of the conversation.
Ah.
And that I have learned to do because, you know, I've had to learn that I'm not in charge.
And I guess some people need to feel that they were right, right? Maybe that person was difficult. And when you said you're right, you know, what could they do then? Oh.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There's kind of a tone. I think a lot of people are not given consequences to their behavior when they're growing up. So if I swore, you know, I had to go to my room. If I said something bad to my mother, my father sent me to my room. If I got into trouble at school in those days, my mother would find a punishment or a consequence because she believed the school. The school told her that I was misbehaving, and I don't know what I would have done. But my experience as a teacher was that if the school told the parent the child was misbehaving, the parent said to the school, and continues to do this to this day, it's like, well, what are you doing to him? You know?
Wow.
So very few consequences are laid into our young people, and I think that was true also when I was growing up, this sort of like permissive parenting or let's make sure our kids are always happy. And what you're finding now is we've got all these adults that are, you know, if they don't get it their way, they go find another job or they go do something else and they don't take, I'm generalizing, so I shouldn't.
No.
But there are a lot of people in the parenting field now who are starting to write books about, you know, you've got to set boundaries for your children.
Right. Now that's interesting. So would you say that this is a society now that's raising a lot of difficult people because there are no consequences. They're just letting
children
get away with things. And
we certainly have a government that thinks it can get away with everything. No matter which political party you're part of, they don't seem to feel that there are any consequences for their behavior. So if nothing else, sorry. I know that's a real downer, so let's change the subject.
The society. Well, oh God. Well, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, that statement is my way or the highway. But if everybody says that, then we go nowhere, right?
Totally. Yeah. So difficult people are difficult for everybody. Has a difficult kind of person. You know, somebody might find me difficult, someone else might not. So I'm not trying to say the whole world is difficult or everybody in our culture is difficult. I think difficult people tend to, unless they've had someone point out to them that they're not king of the world or queen of the neighborhood, they can be annoying. So we all have somebody in our lives who we just sort of would cheerfully strangle if we could, right? Everybody. I think there's two women in my church who are so accepting and so completely centered that they don't have any difficult people. But everybody else.
Oh, yeah, that's funny.
If I mention it. You know, most of us have someone that it's a neighbor or a family member or a colleague. Depending, like, I had a neighbor that just drove me bats, but it wasn't worth the trouble to try and explain to him why it was such a problem for me, because he was my neighbor, and we didn't have an intimate relationship, and we just wanted to get along. So I wasn't about to say to him, do you know when you do that, it really drives me crazy. The one thing he and his family liked to do target practice, because they hunted deer and things in the fall, and we had long rectangular plots of land. So when he was standing in the middle of his plot shooting towards the other end, and if my son was playing out in the yard, I was fearful for his safety. And so I used to point that out to him and ask him to please tell us when he was going to do that so we would bring our son inside. And he, of course, wanted to teach my son how to shoot the gun, and I said that wasn't really an option, but he was free to shoot him himself, you know. So I never confronted him. I never had a conversation with him about, do you know, when you shoot your gun or when you yell at your wife or some of the things that he did, it's a problem for us because there wasn't really an impact on us that was ever going to mean anything to him. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The safety of my son would. But the impact of the behavior has to mean something to the person you're telling. So my process, at least what I'm trying to teach in the book, is very effective at work, and it also can work in family situations too. But if it's somebody that, it's worked with volunteer groups and some church groups that I know, but it takes time to have the conversation with the difficult person, and there has to be some kind of a relationship to start with.
Well, isn't it? It's tougher to have that conversation with a family member versus someone at work.
Yes. Because family is, everybody knows everybody's buttons. And I think our culture, I don't know if it's because of television or if it's always been this way, but we all seem to be enmeshed in each other's lives, you know? Like, you have somebody's ex-husband, angry, or a woman was talking to me the other day about her ex-husband has a girlfriend, and their daughter, who is in her 40s, doesn't like the girlfriend and won't let her father bring her to social events, and she wants the woman that I was talking to be on her side in this. Am I? You know, how important is this family event to her father, you know? Because, I mean, this young woman seems to think she's in charge of everybody's relationships and lives. And so that I don't think that's unusual. I think that's what our TV shows are made of, aren't they?
Yeah, like a soap opera, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
so it's almost like we spend too much time looking at other people's lives and, you know,
you think?
Yeah, interfering with other people's lives and not spending enough time developing ourselves, right?
Or... because it's all their fault.
Ah, yeah.
You know who's really good at this is Mike and Molly. I was watching that the other night, and they always end up in a positive way, but they start by misunderstanding each other, and then, of course, family members of hers, and I guess his mother's involved in it, too. I can't think of a specific example, but I thought it was a sweet way where they just turned to each other and said, well, what we really do is love each other, so why are we doing this? You know, why are we having this argument, or why does it matter? So, yes, we tend to get involved in other people's lives and have opinions about them, and we want to share it with our friends, and they may or may not want our opinion.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. It's a very delicate line, isn't it? Now, what do you say to someone who has a parent who has a child living at home, an adult child, could be male or female, and they're difficult? I mean, how do you handle a situation? And there's a lot of that. There are a lot of children who are not leaving home, as you know, these days.
So say you were this woman.
How do you handle this adult child who is not three, but they're in your house?
Okay. Well, let's pretend that you're Rosemary and this is your child. So what is it that the child is doing? Obviously, they're living in your house. Do you not want them to live in the house?
I don't know. Let's do two scenarios. Maybe one where you don't mind them living there, and then the other scenario is you're big enough to go out on your own, especially if you're not listening to me in my house.
Okay. So that's one thing. Let's take the one where the young person is welcome, but isn't looking for work and isn't respecting your rules or boundaries, right?
Right.
Okay, so what I would do is invite you to get really specific about, was there an agreement that this person would be looking for work? is there a deadline for when they're supposed to have a job, when they moved in? And if not, maybe that's the first negotiation. And secondly, if they're not respecting, like if you've said, please, please put the milk back in the fridge, or please, if you use something up, please replace it, like, you know, mayonnaise or vinegar, or, you know, if you're using the food in the kitchen and you eat something and it's all gone, please go get some more. Or at least add it to the shopping list. Maybe you'd leave it to that. Put it on the list so that we know that we need to buy more. Okay, so those are some specific things that you've asked them to do and they're not doing, right?
Right.
Okay. Then, so the impact of those two behaviors, one is that you're getting to the point of thinking of, you know, getting ready to sell the house and downsize because you're hitting 65. Is that reasonable?
Sure.
Okay, so you have to start thinking about that. So the child can't stay there forever. So one of the impacts is that you're having trouble with your plans since they're still living there. And the second one is that it's just incredibly inconvenient and makes it hard for you to do the cooking for yourself when the child, young person, is eating up all your food and not putting things on the list. And they seem kind of simple, but rather than say it feels disrespectful or you're just not paying attention to my needs, to say something like, when the food isn't written on the list, I can't buy it, and when I go to make a sandwich, I don't have it, and it pisses me off, or, you know, I don't like that. And, you know, I'm paying the mortgage right now, so my rules.
Right.
So having clarified that, then there's some homework that you, as the parent, need to do in terms of, can you be neutral? Can you look at your child? And with a child, it's whether they're adult or little, I've always found it most helpful if I can pretend they're someone else's child.
Ah, so you detach yourself a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah,
so can you look at this young person and pretend they're someone else's child? You could probably say this to someone else's child.
Right.
Right? So is it possible to do that? Can you describe the behavior without putting all those emotion-laden words in there? Can you think of all the things that your child will say in response? And this is one of my fun exercises, is to make a list of all the things that person would say, and you write them down the left-hand side of the paper. And then on the right-hand side, you list all the things that you want to say back, not hostile, but just ways to respond, either active listening or with logic, depending on how. So if the child says, well, you never loved me anyway, you know, something like that, you say, oh, so you're feeling unloved.
Right.
And see what response you get. And then, well, you're picking on me. You've always picked on me. You're always telling me what to do. And so my asking you, if you know you're doing these things, which we'd already agreed were against the rules, if you know you're doing that, I'm picking on you? Is that what you're saying? You just said, I'm singling you out to be mean to you. Is that the way it feels? Now, usually if you're talking to an adult and you're saying it that way, they kind of go, oh, for goodness sakes, Ma, you know.
Right.
they don't go with that for very long. If they say, yeah, then you say, well, tell me more. You know, you can listen to them for a while and let them moan and groan or whatever it is they need to do. But can you also in your head find 5 things that you really like about this person?
Ah. And what does that do when you find the 5 things that you like? Does that soften it a little bit? So,
well, it changes the way we look at them.
Ah.
Remember, all we're doing is taking in information. If we take in the information like, damn it, he ate the bologna all up again, or he left the milk out and now it's sour and I can't put it in my coffee.
Right.
You know, God, I wish he would move out. You know, these thoughts. Well, Really, all you've got is spoiled milk. He could be 5 minutes away with a new bottle of milk. Who knows?
Right.
But so it's your perception. So if you find five things about the young person that you appreciate, that you like, then you're changing the way you look at them.
Ah.
So when you say, I love you, I love this and this about you, and when you moved in, we agreed that you'd have a job by Christmas and it's almost Easter, and you constantly finish up the food and you don't put it on the list, and I ask you please to do that. So I keep bumping into the fact that I don't have food that I thought I had for supper. Do you know you're doing that? Are you doing it on purpose? I used to ask my son, are you doing that to piss me off, or did you forget that I really, really don't like that?
And what did he say to you?
He'd say, oh, Mom. That's all it took.
That's funny.
I remember once he was visiting me after my husband and I had separated, and where I lived was very close to his school, which was quite deliberate, so he could stay here as well as live with his dad. And he was down in the kitchen with his friends, and I came through to get something, and he was a little bit sarcastic and almost rude to me. And his friends kind of laughed. There were three or four boys, and they were 16-ish. And I said, hang on a minute. And I took him out of the room and into my bedroom. I said, are you being rude to me on purpose? Are you doing it because it's fun? Because I really don't like it. And did you forget or something? And he said, Mom. I said, well, I didn't want to say anything in front of your friends, but I don't think they think you're a nice person if you're rude to your mom. They wouldn't be rude to their mom. You know, that kind of conversation. But he was 16. But when I said things like that to him, he'd just say, oh, for goodness sakes. But he stopped.
He stopped.
I have found it to be powerful.
Yeah.
Anyway,
there's
so
something,
there's
power in being positive.
Absolutely. I find that if you can reframe what they're doing in a positive way, and I like to do workshops on this whole topic of dealing with difficult people, using myself as an example. And one of the exercises is to take all the words that we have in our vocabulary that describe people in the negative ways we like to, like controlling and manipulative and, you know, you name it, and reframe them so that we see the same behavior from a positive perspective. I always talk about it as like someone who you think is controlling is really someone you want around because they pay attention to every detail.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
And you really want someone like that on your team.
Yeah.
So you won't miss any details. You can say, what did we miss? What did we miss?
Right. Well, here's the thing. Now, okay, so we dealt with a situation where you're dealing with someone who's a family member. Now, let's create another situation. You're at work, and you have a difficult boss to deal with. Now, you need your job.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you say to someone, I have a difficult boss, I have a difficult coworker who's really tight with my difficult boss?
Aha. Uh-huh.
So how do you handle that situation so that you can ease the situation, so you can keep your job, but also have peace at work? And I'm sure there are a lot of people in that situation as well.
Well, it depends on whether the difficult boss and the difficult coworker, if they're in cahoots or they're doing things that are unethical, or they're doing your job and taking credit for it. I mean, all of that, I don't understand that. So I don't know the answers to that. So the first thing I would say to someone is, if you have people that you work for and with that you just find difficult, can you look at them a different way? So can you work side by side with this person, and whenever they say or do whatever you consider difficult, if you say, oh, that's their quirk, isn't that funny, and just ignore it, can you live with that? That's the first question.
Is can you live with that?
Yeah, because unless it impacts you, like it's your job to do it, or they're being unfair in some way, if your boss is giving all your overtime to your colleague and you need the overtime as much as she does or he does, then I think you have a fair request to say, Mr. Boss, when I took this job, I was told I would be getting overtime, and I haven't gotten any this month. Is that deliberate, or are you planning to give me some? What's going on? I mean, that's really, you don't have to say, I saw he got a lot. You know, that never helps, because the minute you say, well, everybody else does it, or he doesn't do it, or he got more than I did, all you're doing is creating a battle, a war, and what you want to say is, this is the behavior, this is the impact. Was this deliberate? Is this something that you really want? Usually they don't. Now, if this person says your work is so sloppy that I don't want you working overtime, then you know you've got to get a different job. Sorry, that doesn't answer your question. But it depends on the situation. If you have, I just wrote an article about someone whose colleague took credit for her work. So a woman I was working with, and she ended up having a conversation with that colleague. Because the boss came, met her on her way into work and said, hey, did you see what so-and-so did? He did this great new spreadsheet, and he has a whole new report format. And she's like, wait a minute. And she didn't say to the boss, wait a minute, that's mine. She went to her colleague and said, did you do this on purpose? He said, oh, I didn't do it. She said, yeah, you did. Because the boss has already talked to me about it. And it's really not okay. And I just need to know, if this is what you're going to keep doing, then that's good information for me. But the other problem is that I'll probably have to stay in this department a while. And it means every time I create something new or we do a report together, I'm going to have to fact check everything to make sure you're not stealing my work. And it's going to take a lot longer. And we're known for being speedy. So, you know, is that what you want? And he acknowledged that he didn't think that she would find out. And I don't know how he thought she wouldn't find out, but anyway. And then I helped her identify a process so that she had a different supervisor. So every time she created a new process and a new, you know, reporting, I don't understand, it's all informational technology, but whenever she created it, she copied it to her supervisor. Yeah. So that if it ever came up again, like was this his or hers, her supervisor had proof that she had created it.
You know, it's interesting. It seems that the conflict or the difficulty is, as you talk about in your book, is that when you don't get needs met, you know?
Yep.
I mean, that's like the underlying.
Well, that's the motivational part. That it, part of me says it doesn't matter why they're doing it. The fact is they're doing it.
Right.
But that doesn't really, a lot of times, doesn't help. So I talk about motivational needs that drive our behavior. Dr. William Glasser, who founded reality therapy and created choice theory, identified that our behavior is driving or trying to act on the external world, if you will, on everybody outside of us, to get what we have in our head that we think will meet our needs. So, for example, here's a really good example. I grew up not feeling a part of my family. Every time I've been asked, how do you want to celebrate your 40th birthday, your 50th, your 60th birthday, my mom always did things, you know, when we had the 10s, we got to do something special. Every single one of mine was a family event. I wanted all of us to come together and either have a picnic or a party or a weekend where we all got along. Because I still have that need. I still have this picture in my head of a happy family. And we actually were successful a couple of times. One was sort of a disaster, but two of them were good. But that's a long-standing one. But all of us have the need to belong and feel a part of. And Dr. Glasser says that's the most important need. And whatever is causing a problem for you in your own behavior, there's a good chance that some relationship is not meeting your needs at this point, that you're not getting what you really want. Somebody who steals your work, they may feel that that they needed the extra money, that they were going to get promoted, and that way their wife will love them better, because they're not feeling good in their, marriage relationship, or their boss won't fire them because they're not feeling connected or belonging with their boss or with their company. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense.
The most basic need is the need to belong, but we also have the need to have fun, a need of freedom and liberation and a sense of making choices. Another one is a need for standing, having our uniqueness recognized, a sense of achievement. So fun, freedom, belonging, achievement. Oh, and survival, of course, physical health and procreation of the species. So those five needs are, Dr. Glasser calls them genetic instructions. They're in our DNA, if you will. What we think will meet the needs is different for everybody.
Yeah.
So at some point, I'm probably going to have to acknowledge that my family of origin is never going to look like Father Knows Best. Just not going to happen.
But, I was thinking about the two ladies you mentioned in your church, and you said these women probably don't really encounter, I forget how you worded it, but basically
difficult people.
They don't encounter difficult people. So what is it about them that they do? Because we all want to eliminate difficult people from our lives, I guess.
Yeah.
But you can. Right.
If we stop judging each other, that's
right.
Step number one. Do you know Brené Brown? Have you read any of her books?
No.
Oh, you have a treat in store.
Okay.
Her name is Brene, but it's pronounced Brene. It has an accent. Brown. She's a professor of sociology in Texas somewhere. I should know more.
Right.
She has written a number of books, but she does research. She's been doing like over 10 years of research on vulnerability. And what she says is the essence of being alive is being vulnerable.
Mm.
And in order to allow yourself to be vulnerable, you have to let down some of those defenses.
Ah.
And one of the things she said that I really, really like, she said, to assume the best about people is an inherently selfish act. If I believe that you are in my corner, it's selfish because then I don't have to defend against you. It makes life so much easier. I was listening to a woman on NPR today who was talking about a new process they have about cooking where people can sign up online to come to your house and eat a meal. And the narrator was asking the chef, don't you worry about the people that come into your house if you don't know them or something. And she said, I really believe all people are good. And when they come, they will be good and they will enjoy my food. And she said, I've been doing this for quite a while and I've never had it work any other way.
Hmm.
So assuming the best about people is an inherently selfish act. I just think that's classic.
Yeah.
And that's dropping the judgment. So what these two women that they're my mentors here, they stay out of other people's business. And I teach a little bit about that concept in my book. That's a whole concept from Byron Katie,
right,
who has created the work. And she says there's my business, which is everything about me. There's your business, which is everything about you. And everything else is God's business.
Ah.
So when I was annoyed at the interviewer,
right,
I was in his business because I was feeling judgmental about what he was saying or the tone of voice he was using. And I want to say, you don't understand that. Whoa, hello.
Yeah.
I'm in his business because I want him to be different.
Mm, interesting.
And it's very challenging.
Yeah.
And, of course, to arrive at that point, it's not something, but telling myself, oh, I don't want to be in her business, it's the first step, but it doesn't usually get me out of her business. Byron Katie has a whole process that you can go through to kind of look at what you really wish you'd like them to be, and then how the belief that this person should be different is just as true as the fact that they aren't different.
You know, on your book, you say, in daring to dialogue with a difficult person, we not only have to describe the behavior we find irritating, but we also have to identify the impact of the behavior. If the difficult person isn't aware of the behavior, then they probably aren't aware of its impact. The impact can be on the other people in the difficult person's life, like family members, colleagues, customers, clients, and volunteers, or it can be on the difficult person themselves.
This is true. Although the only person who probably would be useful if the impact is on the difficult person himself or herself, you know, it's got to be a trusted, intimate person, like a minister or a rabbi or counselor or maybe a spouse. But, you know, you wouldn't say it to your best friend. Well, I think you're hurting yourself.
Right.
They may be pretty wrapped up in their belief. I have another thought, another quote. I don't know who said it, but take no offense. That which offends you only weakens you.
Ah.
Being offended creates the same destructive energy that offended you in the first place. I know. I used to say to my mother at various times, well, I hate that person and I hate that. She'd say, oh, don't waste your time hating people. It takes too much energy.
And then, you know, a lot of times, and we kind of touched on it earlier in our conversation, that sometimes people are difficult because of fear. So, and you say we have to stop at this point and look at ourselves. It is natural and common to want to avoid conflict because of fear. One way to overcome fear is to gain insights into what is causing the fear and how to improve the chance of resolution through conversation.
So, but look, I don't know what page you're on, but to figure out what's causing the fear in you, not the other person.
Right.
So it's not like you don't say to the difficult person, well, what are you afraid of? It's all of the work really that has to go on to prepare for that conversation is self-examination so that you can be neutral.
Right.
So you can be like those women that I admire so much who just aren't judgmental. Because in the conversation, you really want to be able to listen. Byron Katie has a wonderful practice that she calls literally listening, and I didn't put it in the book. And if I ever...
You can put it in your next book.
Putting it in the next book. I'm writing a blog about it right now because I just realized I should have put it in there, but I didn't put it in. But literally listening is when you just listen. You don't say anything. You don't ask any questions. You listen, and you can have eye contact, and, you know, your facial expression can be with them. But you don't stop and say, wait a minute, explain that to me. What did you mean when you just listen? And when they ask you a question, then it's your turn to talk.
Yeah. And you stress active listening. Could you explain active listening?
Well, active listening is when you listen to the emotion underneath their response.
Ah.
So everybody hates me. Oh, you're feeling really alone.
So is it sort of, would you say it's kind of listening with your heart as opposed to your mind more?
It's at the heart level. You might need to use your mind to figure out what emotion they're feeling. The thing about active listening is that you suggest to them, oh, you're feeling X or you're feeling Y. And if they aren't, they'll say, no, that's not right. I feel this way.
Ah.
So they'll tell you. What it does is it allows the conversation to go on without judgment and without asking them to change. You've probably already suggested to them what they're doing is causing problems for you and for others. So they're now reacting, and they usually feel picked on or teased or I'm running out of words, but you know, when someone is in a moment of pain or defensiveness, as I would have said, it's not my fault. So you're feeling blamed. You're feeling really alone there, that you're doing something that someone else made you do.
Okay, so I have two things for you. One is, can you just give us a quick, and really people should get the book, because you really you have exercises and things, mm-hmm. and they need to read your story.
They can skip it if they want.
But no, they can't do that. But they got to read the book. But if you could just give us a step-by-step approach, just a quick summary, how to deal with a difficult person, but also how does a difficult person transform to be an easier person to deal with? How's that?
Well, here's the interesting thing. If you choose to look at the difficult person as not difficult, guess what?
Ah.
They become less difficult.
That's interesting. So, yeah.
So the all the steps, well, there's peace is an inside job, right?
Yeah. I love that. You know, it's funny. We make things more complicated, don't we? We've heard people say, oh, he's complicated or she's complicated.
Mm-hmm,
but are
mm-hmm.
they really?
Well, what's one of the things one of the reasons I wrote the book was because it felt like people had been saying things to me in so many oblique ways all my life. And what I didn't get was I was arguing with authority. I was questioning people because of my persona, which is genetic. I didn't create it. They perceived me as threatening their power, so I was the enemy. And how did I get started on this? The difficult person is just crunching along. Just doing what they do. But I wrote the book because I felt people found it difficult to say, this is X and this is Y. Did you know it?
Mm.
Do you know you do this? Are you aware that it has this impact? And is that what you want? Now I understand that once you say this to someone, they're going to go, you always called me and you've never been and mama, you always, whatever. All the things that somebody will do, especially if it's a family member,
right,
who will blow up at you, or else they'll get really quiet and they won't talk to you at all, in which case you have some more work to do. So in order to get to that place where you can actively listen to them, you need to be really clear about what the behavior is. What are they saying and what are they doing? We don't think in terms of behavior. We say, oh, they criticize all the time. Always critical. What exactly did she say? Well, she's whining. She's such a whiner. Well, what words did she use? What tone of voice did she use? You know, those kinds of getting really concrete. I learned this from parent effectiveness training. So if any of your listeners are working as parents, I highly encourage them to get it. It's very simple. The effectiveness training people are still out there doing this work. And it teaches you to be really concrete about what you're saying, about what the difficult person is saying to you and what they're doing, what actions they're taking, because they don't know they're doing it.
Right.
I promise. Now, the kid, when you were growing up, you probably had the same thing where you had a kitchen door that had a screen door and you ran out and it slammed and you ran out and your mom was like, don't slam the door, and you slammed it. So it's that kind of thing where you just do it without thinking. So a lot of, I believe, most difficult behavior is a habit, and someone hasn't taken the time or the interest to really describe it. So that's the first step.
Right.
Is identifying it. Then the process, of course, and the out and the impact. If it doesn't have any impact on anyone, and it just really drives you crazy, then you need to go read Loving What Is by Byron Katie, because then you're in that person's business, and you know, you can tell them that it drives you crazy, but don't expect them to change.
Right.
It's just, I mean, you can't make, you know, I mean, I remember what a big deal it was for me for lifting up the toilet seat, you know, when I was married. I had a husband and a son, and I was going, rah, rah,
right.
And you know what? It's not such a big deal.
Yeah.
It, you know, you don't want to base a relationship on that kind of thing, but sometimes we do.
Yeah.
I didn't, but I mean, sometimes people do. So,
and sometimes, I guess, you know, I'm thinking about these two lovely ladies in your church. And
yes,
I guess the thing about them is they just accept people for who they are. They don't try
exactly.
to change them. And
mm-hmm.
and I guess when people feel accepted for who they are, then they aren't difficult. They feel acceptance, and that kind of transforms the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've all been in situations like, I don't know how you get along with that person. How do you do it? And it's probably because they just accept them. They're not trying to change them. They're not judging them, like you said. They're
There's a woman. Go ahead.
Yeah.
There's a woman named Jill Lublin who's recently written a book about the prophet of kindness. It's all about being kind in the workplace. And she says, stop reacting.
Actually, I'm actually interviewing her. That's funny.
Oh, good. You'll
yeah.
love her. She's
right.
terrific. But I've added that to just sort of that's one of the things I want to put in my next book. It's like, this is what we're talking about when we're saying be non-judgmental. And the last thing is, if someone's really looking for how do I work on myself, if that's what it is you want to do, so that I can be more accepting. There's a wonderful book called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. Do you
right.
know it?
Yes, I actually have that book.
Okay.
Right.
Well, the first one is to be impeccable in your word, which means what you say as well as what you think. The second is don't take anything personally.
Ah.
Ha! So when someone leaves the seat up or leaves their dirty socks on the floor or slams the door, if we take it personally, that's on us. The third one is don't make assumptions, and the fourth one is always do your best. We assume so much. We watch somebody, like, sitting in a restaurant and somebody's baby starts crying, and you think, well, you shouldn't have brought that baby along with you. You should have brought food for them. You should go change
right.
that baby. You should this, you should that. You know, that baby's sick. Who knows what it is? It's not our business.
Right.
We don't want to make assumptions about people. I feel like I've been talking for a long time. I hope. Anyway,
no,
you asked
actually,
me,
but
what,
no,
what's
it's the, wonderful. It's wonderful.
Okay. Well, what is it we do is we identify the behavior, we identify the impact. What do they say? What do they do? How does it impact? And then can you do at least those things for like the four agreements? Can you look at this person and not take it personally? Can you not make assumptions about why they're doing it? Letting go of your assumptions. People will say to me, well, I think she's doing this because, and I say, you know, that may be true, but it doesn't matter. Because the fact is, this is being said, this is being done, and this is the impact it's having on the customers.
That's
so
great.
That person will probably tell you all the reasons she does it, and you can listen to it. And say, I hear you. You feel passionate about this. This is important to you. And if you want to be here or be in this family or whatever the scenario is, there's one in my book where the daughter says to her mother, freshman in college, says, Mom, if you want me to come home, you got to stop asking me about boyfriends.
Ah, right.
You know, it's sort of not your business, Mom. But saying it in a loving way.
Right. And how about for the difficult person who recognizes mm-hmm. that they're difficult, who wants to transform themselves? What do they do?
Well,
is it
either Don Miguel Ruiz's book or Byron Katie's book would be helpful to start. It's a whole process of self-examination, and I check it out now. I mean, if I see a flicker or I feel a flicker in something that I've said or done with another person, I stop and say, wait a minute, are we okay?
Right.
Did something I say just offend you? Because you know, we joke about it at my church now because I say, well, now, you know, I'm a difficult person, so you got to tell me if I'm being difficult. And
humor.
Everyone laughs, but, you know, it sort of helps.
Humor is good, right? Humor.
Well, and also just I found myself in the stressful moment of helping with a potluck where the minister asked us to do, I don't know, lay tablecloths on all the tables or something, and we had almost everything ready, right? And then it came to me because for whatever reason they'd put me in charge of it. And I gave him this look and said, well, yeah, I guess so. I guess we can do it, you know. And he sort of looked alarmed and said, well, if it's too much, I said, no, it's fine, we'll do it. And then I kicked myself for the next minute and a half for like, of course you're going to do it. He wants you to do it. It's possible to do. Stop being such a prima donna here. And we went and did it. And then I found him 5 or 10 minutes later and said, I want to apologize for my reaction because I know it was kind of huffy and you were not asking for something unrealistic and out of bounds. And he said, oh, it's fine. We're fine.
That's interesting.
I have to go back and do that now. Otherwise, I think I'm difficult.
Ah, yeah. So do you think you're difficult now?
Hopefully not at this very moment. Well, people will say, what did you do to stop being difficult? And my response is always that the jury is out on that. They have not come back. I will tell you, probably there are people in my life that still find me difficult, but maybe the hostility and critical judgment that I used to carry around isn't there as much as it used to be.
Well, you're probably really comfortable with yourself, and I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, right?
More comfortable than I was before I wrote the book, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the other thing about these two women that I love so much, is they are completely comfortable with themselves, and I would love to be completely comfortable with myself.
Yeah, well, I guess like everything, it's all a process. Now, now
like
tell
me. Every time I think, okay, I solved that. No, here's another level to it, you know.
It's like, I guess the work. There's always the work, right? Like Byron Katie says. Because she called it the work. And I guess the work is ongoing.
Well, and when you ask her a question, she sort of stops and she runs through her screen of questions of like, I don't think I have an opinion about that. Or, yeah, I guess I agree with that.
Right.
She's such a thoughtful person, but she's so dynamic.
Yeah.
Have you ever had her on your show?
No, I haven't. Maybe
yeah,
I should.
I don't. Well, you know, I don't know how much she travels. She does her workshops around. I was really blessed and was able to go to her school, which is 9 days.
Wow.
In California. And they have a tremendous scholarship program, and they scholarshiped both my hotel and my tuition.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I think
wonderful.
They thought that I was a minister in the church and not a volunteer coordinator, but it really was very powerful. And I keep coming back to it. It doesn't, whatever speaker I'm listening to or whatever book I'm reading, I keep finding this thread is woven through of don't react, don't take things personally, stay out of everybody's business, stay in your own business. That whole assumption, let's assume that the world is a good place. People are good.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Now tell us about the work that you do for the William Glasser Institute.
Okay, William Glasser Institute is the institute where people can learn reality therapy or find a therapist who is practicing reality therapy, which means that the therapist will listen but focus on current behavior and future behavior much more than past behavior. And what I do for them is I help train those counselors, therapists. It's very useful, the choice theory and reality therapy, the whole process is very useful in the classroom. Managers use it all the time. Even Dr. Phil has adopted it. You know, his whole concept of how's that working for you, that came from Dr. Glasser.
That's interesting that he deals with current and future as opposed to past.
Mm-hmm,
because traditionally in therapy, they always go to the past, right?
Yeah, and I have a friend who's a coach, and he says, well, the difference between coaching and therapy is that therapy deals with the past and coaching deals with the future. And I said, well, not really. Reality therapy is much more like coaching. People who practice reality therapy also usually have other modalities, so, you know, they're not, but their focus is to, if you need to talk about the past, okay, but let's look at what's going on now. Remember, it's based on the five basic needs. And we need to know what needs you're getting met, which needs aren't you getting met, what do you think would meet the need, and is that picture realistic? I mean, for me to believe that my family of origin will sit around a table and love each other the way I envision it is completely unrealistic. For one thing, my parents are both dead, you know. So I could probably let go of that picture, don't you think?
Right. That's a good point.
I could look for that family in other places.
Right.
And I have. But right. But that's my point. So reality therapy works from that concept. And if you go to the William Glasser Institute webpage, it has an explanation of what the therapy is. It has ways to connect with people. And my job at this point right now is I can teach the basic week of intensive training for folks who want to learn it, and then I also can supervise people in their basic and advanced practicum. So it's fascinating. I've been doing it for over 30 years. I'm not a therapist. I'm very clear about that, but I am probably what would be called a coach. I call myself a consultant. So people will call me with some issues about a difficult person. And the first conversation is always for free. And then if we decide we want to work together, usually I work maybe 3 to 5 times, conversations. And it's usually over the phone because people are all over the world, but for a fee, and then help them through the conversation. And usually they have to have more than one, because the first one is really, unless the individual is working a program of recovery the way I was, they may not hear you the first time.
Ah, yeah, that's wonderful.
But they'll react and they'll come back. Yeah, so it's fun. I enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Do you have anything to share that we haven't covered, and any closing reflections?
Well, one of the things that Dr. Glasser identified were the things that build relationships. He called them the 7 caring habits. And this is, you know, if you found that list of 4 things, the 4 agreements tough, try this one. Here are the habits that will build our relationships: being supportive, being encouraging, listening, really listening, not trying to think of what you're going to say next or ask a question, literally listening. Accepting, trusting, respecting, and negotiating differences. And I have had teachers come back to me, having taken our intensive training, and said, I have set these up in our classroom, and said, these are the rules for how we are together in our classroom. And she says, it's the difference between night and day when something's going on, and she can look over at them and say, is what you're doing a caring habit or a toxic habit?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I was just thinking to myself, what beautiful work you're doing. And, you know,
Thanks.
And it's even hard to believe that you were ever a difficult person, you know. So
I had a friend from college. We dated for a couple of years in college, who wrote me. He was so sweet. He said, you know, I always thought you were just a spoiled little brat who wanted what you wanted when you wanted it, but I guess you had some real issues growing up, didn't you? he enjoyed the book, you know, but I thought, oh, well, I think I was pretty difficult.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
What a transformation you've made. And the thing that's so great is you were able to make the transformation, and then now you're reaching out and helping others. Which is a beautiful thing.
Thank you. Yeah. What my passion is, I know what it's like to feel like there's some kind of disconnect between me and the people around me. I know what that feels like, and it doesn't feel good. And so if you've got difficult people in your life, I promise you they don't know what they're doing. I promise you that they would like to have a closer connection. And if you can, if you're willing to read the book and do some of the exercises, you can probably build a stronger relationship with them.
Yeah, the exercises.
And that's the people I care about.
The exercises are great. I love the exercise on page 40. But people really have to get the book, because you and I could talk for a while. And we have.
Well, this is the one where you write down exactly all the negative behaviors and see if what you've really written is a behavior or a judgment, because 90% of the time we are talking about a judgment. Well, she's too critical.
Right.
That's not really a behavior. That's a description of their behavior. Really, we typically put our emotional description of their behavior and think we're describing it. We're not literal enough to say, well, she said this, she did that. I had a couple of people say to me, well, you're sort of like, it's like Dragnet. You know, you have to get really, really, really just the facts, ma'am. And I say, yeah, really neutral. Stay neutral. So, yeah, that's a good exercise.
That's beautiful.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it has.
A lot of good questions.
Yeah, it has been fun. Well, you know, I missed a lot of my questions. I didn't even get to ask you.
Well, you just ask me back anytime. I like doing radio interviews.
Yeah. Well, it's been a lot of fun. And thank you so much for doing the work.
You're welcome.
It's really beautiful. Take care.
I'll do my best. You do the same.
Okay. Until next time, I'm looking forward to your next book.
You have to give me a little time on that one, but thanks. I'm writing some blogs, so they're on my website, sarahelliston.com. So if you really want, you know, give me a week to get one finished here. And, you know, there's more to come.
Well, you could always do a book of your blogs, you know.
Eventually.
Yeah. That's a book. You're actually writing the book.
Maybe so.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
See you later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I would like to thank our guest author, Sarah H. Elliston, for being here to discuss her book, Lessons from a Difficult Person, How to Deal with Difficult People Like Us. For more information, please visit www.sarahelliston.com. I would like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, and connecting here online with Andrea. Listen to me live or listen to the archive. Just continue connecting heart to heart. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others. And never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea with your host, Andrea Garrison.